So I was pretty optimistic about Day of Honor until I saw that it was written by Jerry Taylor, and then I realized what I was in for.
Jerry Taylor is the one responsible for all of Tom Paris's double entendres.
I think so.
Oh,
yes.
Oh,
yes.
God. So she's a cat lady, isn't she?
Unless she passed it on to someone else and Brannon Braga wrote all of them. He sweetened the script. That's possible. I don't know.
Sweetened is a very relative term right now.
Yeah. I didn't hate this episode, but I also don't think it has much to recommend it. And what's worse is there is a real disconnect between what Jerry Taylor was trying to do with Tom Paris and B'Elanna and what the rest of the writers were trying to do with them, in that Tom Paris kept saying, I want to be your friend. Why don't you let me be your friend? And then suddenly B'Elanna realizes that she's in love with Tom Paris, even though they've never had any sort of romantic or anything happen before. And oh my God, we're talking about straight people again.
Yeah, yeah. They just need to settle their own problems. And, you know, that's really our... If we teach the world one thing... It's straight people need to clean up their houses. I mean, I feel like that could be our impact on the world.
I think that is our impact on the world. And I think that perhaps in the far future, we will start a limited series podcast called that, where we just actually yell at straight people.
We could take questions.
Sure.
And they'd be like, I have this relationship problem. And we'll be like, just grow the hell up. Like, what's wrong with you? Be adults about this.
And I think this could have worked. Like, if they want to have a romantic couple on the show, sure, B'Elanna and Tom, why not? Let's go there. Let's do it. I think that they're fine. You know, Tom Paris is a smarmy sex addict and B'Elanna is a hot-headed whatever she is. That's great. I'm okay with that.
You know, I'm fine also with the idea of having a relationship that's based on a very strong friendship. I mean, that is one of those things that people always talk about, oh, friend zoning and, you know, crap like that, and how that's a problem. Like, I think it's fine if you have B'Elanna and Tom's friendship be a very strong foundation for a relationship, and that is, like, that's an okay, fine message to put into the world.
Yeah, no, I think it is too. I mean, I do like the fact that B'Elanna was the one to sort of ramp up the I guess relationship at the end of this episode. But, you know, and maybe I'm just looking for things to criticize because I find myself not liking Jerry Taylor scripts, but I don't know that I am. For me, what it comes down to is that Tom Paris has been portrayed as someone who has been aggressively pursuing a friendship with B'Elanna. And aggressively pursuing a friendship with B'Elanna in exactly the way that all women all throughout the world have been saying for the past however many months the Me Too stuff has been going on, and of course before that as well, that you don't want to have a man go after you like this. I mean, you either you want to be friends with a woman or you don't, but don't attempt to create a friendship with ulterior motives, which I think is what Tom Paris was doing.
Well, yeah, so I mean, that's... Part of me is really unsure how to read all of Tom Paris's overtures to his friendship. Is he, you know, is friendship a code for anything else? And it seems to depend on the script. I mean, I think it's fine if he's, you know, at the point of, listen, like, we work together, we have the same goals, we have a lot in common, like, we're friends, you need to stop picking on me, like, and actually admit that we're friends. Like, that's fine. Is it saying, like, no, you actually like me, you actually do want to sleep with, you know, you want some Paris in you, you know, you want to, I love the face you just made. You know, I mean, yeah, I it's really unclear. Now, in this one, yes, all of his, you know, I'm going to share your oxygen and we're going to, you know, merge our comm units together and I'm going to put my peg into your suit hole and all of that stuff, like,
I think the one that got me was, I can't believe it took us this to initiate first contact. And I was shoot me, please. Just pull out a phaser and shoot me now. Make sure it's on the kill setting. Please just end it. End it right now.
Oh, God.
But yeah, like, I guess that's the problem, though. Like you said, is that, and this is where Voyager's inconsistent characterization and inconsistent writing, I think, comes to hurt it, in that I don't know how we're supposed to react to any of this, because it seems like whoever wrote that episode's script and put in a Tom and B'Elanna subplot or a Tom and B'Elanna scene didn't really know where this was going, didn't really get any direction from anyone. I'm speculating, but that seems to be the case. And so everyone that wrote these scenes in these episodes had very different ideas, or even slightly different ideas, frankly, about what exactly the character motivations of Tom Paris and B'Elanna Torres were in these scenes. And we are left with very incomplete information to draw any sorts of conclusions. Now, you know, Jeri Taylor is the showrunner. She wrote the script for this episode. So her word is sacrosanct in some respects. So, okay, they are now pursuing some sort of romantic relationship. But it's just frustrating because I want to like Star Trek Voyager. I really do. And I like it sometimes, but sometimes it's just so frustrating.
You know, and I have to be, even the final lines when, you know, B'Elanna finally admits, you know, I love you, and he goes, oh, you picked a great time to tell me. Now, is this Voyager's attempt at being, you know, Han Solo's I love you, I know? Or is this like, Nemesis doesn't really go into their relationship anymore. Like, it puts that plot on hold for a moment. So I'm not I can even read that line as him being like, oh, Jesus, like, this entire time, like, I have just been wanting to be, like, a really good friend of yours because we are friends. And, you know, all of the double entendres is, you know, I'm Tom Paris. I'm kind of gross, you know, but, you know, at the end of the day, you're still, you know, I think of you as a sister. Or is that like his, like, you know, I'm too cool to say I love you, too. Like, I don't know how to read it.
Yeah, I don't know how to read it either. And I think that, you know, I mean, let's go back to Blood Fever, right, from the third season, where, you know, Torres was under the influence of Vorix hormones or whatever the hell happened there, some sort of mind meld.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was that really good scene, I think, that was very strong in consent, where Tom Paris essentially said, look, you don't want me to do this. I, you know, you are not in a mental position to consent to this. And I don't want to do it either, frankly, in the condition that you're in. And, you know, you can elide that by saying that Tom Paris did or did not say whether or not he actually was attracted to B'Elanna.
Yeah.
I think that episode at least makes it clear to me that he is. But then they sort of forget about that for a lot of the other episodes that they appear in, and they just seem to be buds again. And I just don't know what to make of this. Like, I don't know. Is it possible that we just don't have enough experience being straight people to understand what's going on here?
I mean,
guess that's a question for the audience. Like, most of you are straight. What's going on here?
Yeah, I mean, like, as a gay man, like, there are friends that I've had sex with that it's not, like, a big expression of, like, romantical love. It's just been, you know, two buddies helping each other out kind of a thing. And in a way, the friendship and the sex are, like, you know, it's like my friends who are musicians, like, will play guitar together. Like, it's like that kind of a thing. Like, you know, is that too modern in a different context to say that that's Tom Paris's attitude towards B'Elanna? Like, he is, you know, she's somebody that he gets along with, has a lot in common with, feels very comfortable around, you know. And yes, she's very pretty. And, you know, if they're having a night out together and, you know, it doesn't, date bone, like, you know, that was kind of that was part of the implication of where I saw Troy and Riker getting to, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, if they have shore leave together, they're going to have a nice dinner together. They're going to go out. They are assumedly going to sleep together. But for the most part, like, they know they don't really want a relationship. Their life goals are very different. It doesn't change the amount of affection that they have for each other. It doesn't change the fact that they do love each other very deeply. But, you know, they can have that side of their relationship and their friendship without it being a capital R relationship. Like,
sure.
But then again, this is me not knowing if Voyager is capable of that kind of, in a way, emotional complexity and depth. Again, I can view Riker and Troy as being two people who are able to navigate to that very particular and in many ways precarious kind of relationship and navigate that very well. I mean, the Voyager crew seems so much younger than the TNG crew, doesn't it?
Yeah, I was actually just thinking that. They do seem much younger. And
in some cases, they are. I mean, in the case of Janeway versus Picard, for example, you know. But still, like...
I don't know, because, I mean, the Troy and Riker comparison is interesting to me. And it's interesting because I think there's a real disconnect between early TNG and its portrayal of sexuality, this sort of free love, polygamous influences of Gene Roddenberry. And of course, I mean, I am not discounting the very real possibility that Gene Roddenberry was also sort of a creep as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, that was part of his belief system, and that was part of that was baked into the DNA of TNG. I mean, you see that with episodes like Justice, where everyone is running around in the nude.
Let's not forget that a ship where nobody is allowed to argue with each other means that you can sleep around on somebody who's your girlfriend and she is not allowed by the dictates of the show to get mad at you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that part of that is a little bit misogynistic, of course.
Yeah.
Like Riker was able to basically sleep with every single alien he ever met, but you know, Troy certainly couldn't do that because you're talking about being in the strictures of, you know, a sexist 20th century American culture. But, you know, and then you move on to Michael Piller and you move on to people like Jerry Taylor. And I think charitably speaking, these are, you know, well, I was about to say they're talented. I mean, I think that Michael Piller in general is a more talented showrunner than Jerry Taylor. I would not necessarily say that either of them were better or worse writers than each other. I just don't think Jerry Taylor is as good a showrunner as Michael Piller. But both of them, in terms of sexuality, seem to have a very, very traditional view of relationships and sexuality, much more than Gene Roddenberry did. And so as TNG and Voyager evolved, you get more and more into this sort of tiresome heterosexual thing going on that I just don't care about.
Yeah. I know. I'm not at all invested in the will they or won't they between Tom and B'Elanna.
No. And I mean, a perfect example of this, too, is that, you know, so we're doing the X-Files on our other podcast, Tuning In, which you can find at tuninginshow.com. And I don't think that I've mentioned this at all on any of the podcasts we've done. And we've been podcasting the X-Files for almost a year now. That a large portion of the fan base and a large portion of what was going on that show was a will they or won't they with Mulder and Scully.
We've talked a little bit about that, and I know my take on it has been like, why would that be a thing? Like, it's very clear that they're essentially brother and sister in a way. Like, they are very extraordinarily close, but they are on a, you know, they're not on a romantical level.
Right. And so, you know, that is, I say that more just to indicate like where I'm coming from in terms of like finding this sort of thing interesting.
Yeah.
Now, leaving all that aside, though, we are left with the end of the episode being, I was going to say unambiguous. I don't know that it's necessarily unambiguous, but it's edging towards unambiguous that B'Elanna loves Tom Paris. Tom Paris seems to feel the same for her, and we are going to go with this. I'm okay with it. I mean, as presented, I think I'm okay with the relationship.
I'm really looking forward to I really hope there's an episode where the two of them are trying to keep their relationship secret from Harry Kim, because he would be so jealous that he's losing Tom to B'Elanna. Like that is, but you know, they have been the real OTP for me in Voyager, but.
And I have to say that there was a comment that was left, you know, a few episodes ago that I want to read at the end of this episode. We don't usually do this, but I think we'll get some good mileage out of it. So there's a little teaser for all of you out there. Now, okay, so leaving all of that aside, Tom Paris and Dom B'Elanna Torres are happening. That is a thing. They were stuck in space together. It was done very well. You know, there's a lot of stuff on Memory Alpha about how difficult it was to pull off. It's very interesting. I mean, we tend to forget that, you know, spacewalks on a 90s television show is not necessarily something that was easy for them to do.
No, I'm sure it was technically a very complex episode. It looked fine. It looked good. It was a tense episode in terms of, oh, how are they going to get out of this one? Like, certainly the plot of the episode I rather liked.
Well, I think that's what I want to talk about next, because I do want to talk about the Seven of Nine plot, but I also want to talk about B'Elanna, because I think that This isn't really a Tom Paris episode. I mean, this is named after a Klingon holiday. We have not heard of this day of honor before, but sure. I mean, I'm fine with that. But
there's like a different Klingon holiday every day. It's like the Catholic Church. So I mean,
yeah, pretty much. But what I find interesting about Day of Honor is that in a certain sense, it's a hangout episode until it becomes a much darker episode, because for the first like 15 or 20 minutes, it's just B'Elanna talking to various people about how much she does or does not want to engage in the Day of Honor. And B'Elanna is a character that I think the show was very interested in early on. I think the show has become less interested in her as it has progressed through the seasons. I can't really think of the last B'Elanna episode we got. I think it may have been early on in the third season, remember? And so it's been a while. You know, she's there. She does things. She is in engineering. She has a couple of scenes, and she does have this relationship with Tom Paris that's developing. But this is really the first sort of like solo B'Elanna storyline that she gets in a while. And it also speaks to the fact that we haven't really had her examine or I guess not examine, but we haven't had her freak out about her Klingonness in a while. I mean, going back to something like Faces from the first season, for example. So I don't know. I mean, it seems fine to me. I think that what is a little bit tiresome about it, though, is that B'Elanna seems to get this sort of storyline every season where she is upset at getting upset. She's, you know, she has problems with her Klingon half, and then she comes to terms with it, and then she seems to forget. And a season later, we get the same storyline for her again.
Yeah, I mean, that's... At this point, I feel like I've submitted to it, right? Like, there's a degree of that's Voyager, you know, they're not going to really, this is not going to have characters learn and grow that much from their experiences. If this is something that she's, you know, I mean, it doesn't really bother me in the way that I think that in real life, your demons kind of resurface. You think you have everything under control, and then you just have a shitty day. I mean, she is, you know, it is very clear that, you know, yes, part of her having the shitty day is because of her trepidation towards the Day of Honor. But, you know, waking up late, having all this crap happen in engineering, having this malfunction is stuff that's happening to her. So, in other words, it's, you know, it's everything compounding. She is in a stress situation, and you know, you think that you've got everything wrapped and under control, and then it just leeches out and comes at you. And, you know, B'Elanna is not, again, this is a place where there are no therapists. There is nobody, you know, she doesn't have anybody that she can talk to about this stuff who can really understand her. She doesn't have anybody to be exactly on the same level of her. And so, yeah, I think she does kind of tamp things down in a way.
I think the best she gets is Neelix, and I think that Neelix is the closest this show has to a counselor, which is a little scary, of course, because I don't think that Neelix is very good at being a counselor, but he tries, and I like the scene with, you know, it's interesting because Neelix and B'Elanna are not two characters that get a lot of screen time together, and I think we see why in this episode, because they're strangers. They don't really know each other. I mean, there's no reason why they would. Neelix is the cook, and Neelix is the ambassador, or whatever he is at this point. And B'Elanna is the engineer, and she goes there and she complains about Neelix's cooking, but they don't really have anything to do with each other. They don't even really have any friends in common. And so that kind of makes sense to me. But, you know, Neelix's offer to her in this episode is interesting, because I think it speaks more to, like, there's two things going on there. I think, A, Neelix is just a nice guy, and he is trying his best to help everyone as best he can. And I also think it speaks to the fact that everyone is really tired of B'Elanna. Like, frankly.
Yeah. No, I mean, there is something very... And Neelix is not Starfleet, right? And he probably will never become Starfleet. I mean, by the end of this, I don't picture him ever putting on a uniform in the series. I don't know if that will happen or not, but what we have seen by Neelix so far, he is an independent. And yet, That is kind of a very Starfleet kind of an offer in a way. Like, listen, we're both on the same side. We may not be friends, but we have the same goals in common. You know, we're on the same team, and, you know, I may not be able to understand you. You know, I may not get what's going on. I may not be able to exactly do this, but I can, you know, make you some blood pie and... You know, if you need to scream at somebody, like, it's okay. Like, you know, and it's sweet in his way.
Yeah, it is sweet. I mean, I shouldn't joke about it too much. I think that Neelix is a nice guy.
And I mean, I like that B'Elanna has the reaction of, you know, that's not really going to help, like, at all. But,
right.
You know...
Even make things worse.
Yeah, but she recognizes the place the offer is coming from, and I think to a degree that might be enough for the moment, at least.
Yeah.
Like, it's a nice, you know, it's at the very least, Neelix is not saying, like, well, here's how you get over that anger, or, you know, you shouldn't do that, but he's saying, like, no, lean into it. If you want to lean into it, I'm here. And, you know, it's accepting of her in that way, because that is who Neelix is. Neelix is accepting of everybody who comes into his cafeteria.
Yeah, sure. Because, I mean, that's the other part of it, too, is that I think that, you know, we say that B'Elanna hasn't really grown, and then that's part of what Voyager just does. But I think, you know, that's not exactly right.
Yeah.
I think she has grown at least a little bit, because I think the B'Elanna of the first season would have freaked out at Neelix and perhaps would have been angry at his offer. But of course, she's mellowed at least a little bit. So,
yeah,
you know, that definitely is the case, that she has learned how to... She's learned how to take offers of help more gracefully, I think, than she would have, you know, even a season or two ago.
And in her way, take orders. I mean, there is the bit when Chakotay is saying, like, well, 7 of 9 needs to go. And she's, you know, like, no, that's not good. And he's like, no, I'm ordering you. And she, you know, kind of recognizes, like, listen, it's just going to make it worse if I'm flipping out at this. Like, this is happening. I've got to... You know, I'm not happy about this, but there's so much on the ship that B'Elanna is not happy with and just has to run with, because that's the job.
So there's a couple things we haven't touched on yet. I think that the Qatari stuff we can dispense with very quickly. It's another dickish Delta Quadrant species. I think that it ties into something else I want to talk about, and it ties into something we mentioned earlier, which is that Voyager's attention to detail is not quite as good as perhaps we would like. Because, and again, I don't know if that's intentional or not, but I feel like it isn't. That, A, the Qatari say that they were just assimilated by the Borg, even though Voyager was just thrown out of Borg space. So, okay, that's odd, but we can hand wave that away a little bit. The more egregious thing to me is that, you know, the whole reason why these events happen is because 7 of 9 is bored, and 7 of 9 wants to work in engineering, and everybody thinks that her experience with transwarp technology would be good, and they experiment on things and it goes horribly awry and have to eject the warp core. Okay.
And I also don't feel like this is going to be the end of transwarp as a thing. Like, they're gonna keep really?
Oh, no, it definitely is not.
Like, they're obviously going to experiment. I mean, they do find out that it was just a freak accident. They've got more data, but anyway.
But my, and you know, all that plot line is all fine, and I think it works, you know, it works as fine as it can. My issue really is that Tom Paris has a line where he says that he has never piloted a ship at transwarp before, which is on its face untrue because of the second season episode Threshold, where he went to warp 10 and turned into a lizard and had lizard babies with Janeway. Now, maybe the show has retconned it out of existence, which is possible.
Didn't they agree never to talk about that episode again? Like, the captain and Tom Paris had lizard sex. I think everybody on the crew figured, you know what? You know, it's like that episode of The Simpsons. You know, we're never going to talk about this again under penalty of torture. And I think they just forgot about it. So even though it's kind of true, no, it never happened.
All right. I'll go with that. I'll give it to them. I think that if you're going to forget that any episode of the show ever existed, Threshold is maybe not my top choice, but I'll go with top two. How about that?
That I find a lot of references in like other things. Like when people are talking about Voyager sucking, that episode is used as the example. Like Voyager is the kind of show where you like, if you go too fast, you turn into a lizard and have sex with your captain. Like that, that is the,
that episode is Voyager Spock's brain. And you know, is it fair? Maybe, maybe not, but
at least Spock's brain was funny. Like I appreciate Spock's brain.
Well, not to relitigate Threshold, so maybe we should just move on. But before we do that, I want to take a quick opportunity to remind all of you, the loyal listeners of Trek About, that this podcast is supported by you, the listeners. We could not do this without you. If you would like to give us some money, please go to patreon.com/trekaboutshow and give now. Check out our reward tiers. Thank you very much. All right, let's talk about Nemesis.
So the other day on Twitter, Eric, you tweeted something like, one of the problems with Discovery is that they tried to make it cool and Star Trek is never cool. And okay. I mean, that is kind of a issue that, I mean, I saw the first JJ Trek movie and I think that's where they're trying to go with it. They're trying to make it this big, slick, you know, action thing. And, you know, a thing that we've talked about that you've specifically said is that if you love Star Trek, you love it for like the really dorky bits of it, right? Like the you have to like it when it's goofy and stupid and not really making sense. And it was in that spirit that I watched Nemesis, because this is another, here's two cultures at war with each other for no reason. It makes no sense. It's a dumb episode. And I kind of really loved this episode, even though it's not a good episode.
I think that's a really good way to contextualize Nemesis, because you're right. Like, it's not a good episode. It fundamentally doesn't make any sense. And it has a lesson at the end of the episode that I think easily 80% of Star Trek episodes before have had that lesson. So like, we don't really need to hear it again, but okay, fine.
It does feel very TOS. Like I could imagine Captain Kirk in this episode.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. And you know, I think that that's really what is at the core of Voyager, is that Voyager is kind of like most the spirit and the storytelling of TOS. But I don't know. Nemesis is hard for me because I appreciate it. I appreciate what Ken Biller was trying to do. You know, he's on the record as saying, well, all the Star Trek aliens kind of sound the same. And I wanted to do something a little different and give them a little bit of jargon and vernacular of their own. And
I kept writing down quotes from this.
You know, I mean, you just got to glimpse the episode that you glimpse. I think that it's fine. You know, like you said, it's dorky. It's a little silly, but there's something very earnest about it that I appreciate. And I think that earnestness is something that can be very, very, very easily used badly or underused or you know, a little bit of it goes a long way. But it works for this episode. And, you know, if the twist at the end is a little obvious, if the events of the episode don't make a whole lot of sense, at least it sounds interesting, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if this is an episode that I would enjoy watching a second time. And I will say, the TOS version...
The answer is no.
The TOS version of the episode would have had the twist, which I totally called that, oh, the ambassador they're working with is one of the Kraley beasts. But I don't think they would have gone so far as to say, well, and I don't remember the name of the people that, you know, Chakotay is with the whole time.
The Vori.
I don't know if TOS or TNG would have gone so much as to make the Vori legitimately the bad guys in this. Because, you know, they are completely using deception. They are lying. We're told they're using, you know, biochemical weapons. Every bad thing that they're accusing the Kraley of doing, they are doing themselves. They are probably desecrating their dead. All of that. Like, I think they would have figured out a way to write this episode where it is two earnest cultures who are just, you know, at war with each other and using their demonization. But they aren't actually demons. The end of this episode does make the Vori into demons.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, because one of the things that I grapple with about Voyager, and I think that these podcasts are an attempt for me to come to terms with it or figure it out, is that, I don't know, I've really come around to Voyager. I mean, I joked at the beginning of this episode that I really want to like you and you're just not making it hard, Voyager, but I like the show. I think it's good. And one of the reasons why I think it works is that it does episodes like Nemesis. Like, you know, we talked a lot during Deep Space Nine about how Deep Space Nine is different from the Next Generation, right? And its storytelling aims, its metaphorical aims, the points it wants to make, you know, sort of the character stuff that it does. It has a different viewpoint and it has different aims that it wants. And I think Voyager does too. You know, the like you said, the TNG episode of Nemesis, the TNG version of that Nemesis would have gone into both sides more. It would have made it a more morally ambiguous situation. It would have given weight to both sides, I think, more. This episode's not really interested in any of that. You know, it's Ken Biller had an idea to have Chakotay go through a brainwashing experience. And he had the last line in his head probably when he sat down to write this episode. And he worked his way to that end of the episode. It's simplistic. It's moralistic. It's entertaining to listen to, at least. And I think that's really what Voyager is. I mean, it when Voyager's working, it's doing things that are different from how TNG would have done it. And, you know, I think that's another reason why criticism of Discovery for not being Star Trek, I think I find tiresome, because, you know, you could say Discovery is a good show or not, but I'm not super interested in a lot of discussions around if something is Trek or not, because Star Trek is not a religion. And,
yeah,
you know, Star Wars fans can have those arguments. You know, as long as the Federation is not starting wars of aggression and killing people left and right, I'm okay with what Star Trek wants to do. And I don't know. I appreciate that about Voyager. And I'm coming to find that Voyager is not a subtle show. This episode is not subtle, but it works on a weird way.
I mean, I do, you know, I want to talk about earnestness a little bit more, because I don't know, there was something very comforting in this earnestness. In, you know, one of the things we always talk about the Federation is that it, you know, is on the level, right? Like, you talk to someone from the Federation, they're going to be as good as their word. They're going to tell you what they're feeling, you know, all of those kind of things. They're not going to be using deception and all of that stuff. And I mean, there was a sore lack of that. I mean, one of the reasons that, Discovery was not earnest. Game of Thrones is not earnest. Breaking Bad is not earnest. Mad Men is not earnest. Like, there is, even the great shows of our time are not earnest. And there is something that, I mean, that is a very particular tone of this era of Trek. Even DS9 had a lot of earnestness to it. I mean, for all of the darkness that DS9 gets into, it is at no point a cynical show. It is always very optimistic. It is always very, very kind, in a way. And I do miss kindness and earnestness in media to a degree. And, you know, that does not, again, DS9 demonstrates that does not go in hand with childishness or a lack, you know, or frivolity or anything like that. And, you know, Nemesis is not a frivolous or a light episode in any means, but I don't know, to a degree, doesn't it feel like we need this kind of shit?
I'm totally with you. I mean, I think that's a good summation of why earnestness is important and why it's I think why it's so difficult to pull off, frankly. You know, I like you said, I mean, earnestness can very easily spin off into being frivolous or cloying or a number of things. And, you know, to its great credit, I think 90s and early 2000s Star Trek was able to do it for a really long time.
Yeah.
For whatever reason. And I don't think that Voyager always succeeds at that, but it succeeds in this episode, I think. And, you know, a large part of why it succeeds is because it is so single-minded in its goal to get you where you need to be. Mm. You know, part of the reason why the episode works is that you don't see anybody else besides Chakotay and these soldiers for like 22 minutes. You know, you are with him. You are in the shit with Chakotay. That is also his late night talk show.
and I think the I mean, we joke about the language, and, you know, if you don't wrestle your trembles, ally, you have to wrestle them to rages, or they'll nullify. Like, but all of the other soldiers are very soft-spoken, except for that one, you know, time the commander is, you know, rousing them.
Sure.
It comes off as very poetic, and so it is very lulling and seductive. It is very hypnotic to a degree. I mean, it does, you know, the revelation that this is all brainwashing makes sense because, you know, number one, I mean, they're getting Chakotay to essentially speak an entirely different language over the course of the episode. He does slowly start using the slang, number one, to get them to understand what he's saying, and then just because it sounds cool, and then because, you know, that's the mindset he's in. And again, it's a very seductively written episode in that way. Found that very, I really liked that.
Yeah, because I mean, you know, I certainly don't want to compare Nemesis to Darmok because I don't think it's a fair comparison. But, you know, I certainly think that part of, I mean, Darmok is an interesting episode because it is an episode that is basically examining etymology, and it's examining, you know, mm-hmm. how you communicate and how you translate and how you bridge the gap between ideas and verbiage. And Nemesis is an episode where Ken Biller said, all these Star Trek aliens sound the same, and I want them to sound a little different. But in a certain sense, it's a more straightforward version of that because, like, I don't know, you know, a lot of people joke about the jargon in this episode. I also have crack jokes about it. I think it definitely has a sort of like Lord of the Flies aspect to it that I find kind of weird. But I don't know. I admire the attempt, and I think that it does, you're right, like it also serves that purpose of showing exactly how invested Chakotay is getting in this situation. You know, because part of it is like, you know, you're sitting there and you're watching this episode and you're thinking, why is Chakotay going along with this? You know, he's a Starfleet officer for all intents and purposes. I think the show has pretty much forgotten he used to be a Maquis.
Although this episode does, but, you know.
Yeah, and I think that as the show has, you know, as the show has demonstrated in the past, Chakotay was a Maquis for reasons that really had nothing to do with anger or rage or, you know, he was a Maquis because of his father and et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. He was always a peaceful man who was just put into these bad circumstances. Okay, fine. But that's also, you know, links in nicely to Nemesis, of course, because that also highlights exactly the power of this brainwashing. And so as the episode goes on and you're sitting there wondering, why is Chakotay going along with this? He's putting on the uniform. You know, okay, they say, well, it's to blend in. All right, that makes sense. Here's a gun. You need to protect yourself. Okay, fine. But then towards the end of the episode, you know, he's firing the gun. He's going after the guard in the cave. You know, he is invested in this. And the use of, you know, his use of the Vori's jargon is another indication of exactly how far he's gone into this. And I think it's really smart.
Yeah, everything he does is at first out of necessity or easiness, or there's a very, you know, like, oh, hang out with us the night, you know, you're not going to leave in the middle of the night in unfamiliar territory in the middle of the woods. Well, that makes sense. You're right. I'll hang out with you. And then at that point, he's eaten a meal with them and he's bonded a bit, you know, and oh, wear this shirt. You know, are you really going to wear a bright red shirt in the middle? You know, do you know what a red shirt means on this TV in this franchise? You know, come on. Okay, well, that makes sense. All right. Well, you got to learn to use a gun, right? Like, and you got to use our gun because, you know, that's what we got. Okay, that makes sense. Like, every single thing makes sense at first. And then, I mean, it's not even presented to him as a choice almost. And yet, so he just kind of goes along with it because what else is he going to do? Yeah.
Yeah, right. Exactly. What else is he going to do? And there are also elements to this whole story, which, you know, as you're watching it, seem a little badly written. But in hindsight, it's obviously constructed to bring the brainwashing to a conclusion or to heighten the brainwashing. Because, for example, you know, the whole thing about, okay, well, they have to go find Chakotay's shuttle. Let's bring, you know, let's have one of the soldiers go with him. Then the Kraiden find them, kill the guy. That's the big moment of Chakotay, or, you know, that's the big moment in the story of the brainwashing for the brainwashee to get more invested in this. And then, of course, like literally 5 seconds or 10 seconds after that happens, here rolls up the entire platoon. And you're like, wait a second. The whole point of this was that they were going in a different direction than the rest of the platoon. And why were they all so close? And you think to yourself, well, that's just badly written. But no, it's not, actually. It's all part of the simulation.
Yeah, all of this done to give him in stress situations where he doesn't even question that stuff. You know, having this... you know, adorable little girl with the garland of flowers, you know, and she's, you know, I mean, I honestly thought that she was going to be the sister of, you know, the young guy who got killed, you know.
Yeah.
About the only subtle touch was making, you know, her the sister of somebody that he never met. But beyond that, like, yeah, everything is a little saccharine and cliche and stuff. And that's very deliberate.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and I just love her line reading, too. Welcome to Lahana Settlement. You are brightly greeted. I'm going to start saying that to people. Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, I think it's actually a subtly smart episode. And, you know, I think also key to that as well is I don't know, because you could make the argument, and I am certainly not saying that this is an episode of high art or anything like that. I mean, we are still talking about, you know, network television of the 1990s, but... it is designed to make the audience feel smart in a certain sense. And I think that you can get away with that sort of thing a lot, as long as it's not completely transparent. And part of it is that, of course, the audience realizes very quickly that the alien ambassador that Janeway and everyone else is talking to, but never actually see them, are the other aliens, you know, and that kind of thing is designed to make you as the viewer feel like you're really with it and feel like you're really on top of everything that's going on. But it's misdirection, of course, because you're not actually, you actually don't know what's going on. You haven't picked up on the fact that this is all a simulation. I mean, did you pick up on that?
No. And again, and now that I'm thinking on it, maybe there is a degree to where we are supposed to be thinking, oh, what's the TOS version of this episode? It's going to go with the understanding that both sides are really good people at heart and that we're going to, you know, it's just a big misunderstanding. And maybe the point of the episode is that, no, sometimes there are people who are, you know, nice and being demonized and the other people are just fucking neo-Nazis, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, this is really... this episode is not that Ken Biller knows a little bit about how people get recruited into white supremacist gangs, right? Like, you know, based on this episode, it is relatively, you know, subtle and, you know, at first, and it's just a camaraderie bonding thing, and then it gets more serious. And, you know, once you are in, the seduction is so subtle and ingrained that it is difficult to get out of that. I mean, maybe that is a theme that we need to know today, too, that, you know, maybe both sides aren't, you know, nice. Maybe they're, again, there are sides that are patently wrong and are using their propaganda to spread that wrongness and to alleviate themselves of any guilt.
Yeah, yeah. Because, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, at the end of the day, we don't know exactly what the truth of the situation is.
Yeah, it's implied that the Kraley might be using bioweapons, too. You know, it's implied that they might have done some terrible things, too.
Sure, but we don't know. And I think all the information that Chakotay tells Janeway, he gets from the simulation. And, you know, from everything that we've seen of the Kraiden, they're reasonable. They help them find Chakotay. They were very willing to work with Voyager. Now, of course, they could be lying. I mean, this is coming from, this is coming on the heels of Day of Honor, where those alien species got what they wanted and then came back with a huge number of ships to get more. But at the end of the day, we have to go with the information that we have. And the information we have is that the one alien species involved in this conflict helped Voyager and was very reasonable with them. And the other half of the conflict runs this elaborate brainwashing simulation to get additional soldiers, and, you know, also did this to Chakotay. So
yeah,
I don't know. I mean, I think that we have to draw some. But the thing is, like, it's not really the point of the episode. Like, it's almost irrelevant.
Yeah, what matters is that things are not, you know, things were presented as very simple and obvious, and all of these evidence was presented as simple and obvious, but all of that evidence was fake, was fake news, was propaganda. And, you know, what matters is that even Chakotay, who we have known this entire time as somebody who is reasonable and fair and kind and loving and earnest, has gotten to a point where, you know, talking to somebody of, you know, the Kraley species just fills him with disgust. And he, you know, even as he knows that's wrong intellectually, he has been gotten to a point where this is still a feeling in his gut.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know. I want to pose this to you as a question, because I don't know if we have time to really get into it, but what this is making me think about, I mean, I think both of our conversations this week about Day of Honor and Nemesis, is that for a lot of what I struggle with Voyager is, you know, surfaceness and not really diving into the heart of the matter and not really getting into the meat of each situation. And I think that what I'm realizing is that, and I pose this to you as a question, is do you think that's intentional? Like, do you think that part of what Voyager is doing by not getting deeply invested into figuring out what exactly is going on in these situations, because they don't have the time to, and they don't have the resources to, you know, this is one Federation ship. This is one Starfleet vessel that is trying to get home, and they have limited resources and they don't want to waste a lot of time.
Yeah. On a story level, it does make sense. You know, Picard, you know, if this had been an Alpha Quadrant planet, Picard would send a bunch of ships to figure it out, to mediate this conflict, to deal with that. And, you know, to figure out what exactly is being done. Are there concentration camps on this planet? You know, who's running them? Are both sides running them? Where are the prisoners of war? Why is this happening? And, you know, for many reasons, Voyager can't stay and do that. And part of me wonders if there is the intention that this Voyager is supposed to be, Voyager's supposed to be the big Star Trek show now, right? Like, DS9 is for the fans, and this is for, you know, the average Joe who just wants to watch Star Trek for a bit. And maybe if it's a lot less subtle, that's not a bad thing. Again, the message of this episode is a pretty good message to get out there. And if it's, you know, just picked up by somebody, you know, without having, you know, you can watch this episode just in isolation and get a little something out of it. Oh, hating somebody is wrong. It's probably just propaganda. Like, I don't know. Don't you think we need to maybe make some simple messages out there?
Yeah. I mean, and I, you know, part of that is makes me realize that maybe one of the reasons I'm reacting so differently to Voyager this time is because we are in a very different atmosphere.
Yeah.
And we need this kind of show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We need a show to tell people that, like, hating people is wrong.
Well, we do, though, because, you know, like a month ago, a pedophile barely lost a Senate election. So, yeah, we're at that point, unfortunately.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think we'll leave it there. If you have any thoughts on Day of Honor or Nemesis, leave a comment on the post for this episode of the podcast at trekaboutshow.com. Now, we don't normally do this, Richard, and there wasn't really a good opportunity for me to slot this in because Harry Kim was once again a non-entity in both of these episodes.
Oh, are we going to have a Harry Kim episode again? I hope.
So, we don't normally read comments on air, but I wanted to read this one on air because I think that we'll have a brief discussion about it that will be interesting. This was left on the post for Rise and Favored Son. So that was the episode where Tuvok and Neelix got caught in a elevator. And then Fortunate Son was the episode with Harry Kim on the sex planet. And this guy, Christopher Rollins, says, "So if I told you that Harry was meant to come out as gay, but Rick Berman shut it down, would that affect your thoughts on the character?" Now, I responded, "Is that true? I have never heard that." But I also said, yes, it would. And I'm wondering what you think about that.
I mean, I know it's, you know, again, I joked that, you know, Harry and Tom have a lot of really great chemistry, and it's obvious that, you know, and this has been a joke that, you know, a bunch of people had said, you know, have said to me, like, yeah, the biggest couple, the biggest romantic couple on Voyager is, you know, Harry Kim in love with Tom Paris. And, you know, it is something that you could fit this in without it going at, like, for Tom Paris to be revealed as gay would make no sense, right? Like, for, you know, Catherine Janeway to decide that she was gay wouldn't really make any sense. But for Harry, it would, because he has no, you know, and I don't know anything about the actor's personal life, but he has no chemistry with women. Remember his, like, fiance that he didn't really have any interest in? Like, you know, the only person that Harry, you know, I don't know, Harry Kim just doesn't have any romanticness to him, and it feels like something's been taken out in a way. There's something that he's denying, or, you know, I don't know.
I feel like, on the one hand, I feel like it would have been an interesting change for the character, and it would have explained why he was so much of a non-presence in the show, because he was grappling with his own sexuality. On the other hand, I feel like it would have been a little bit like slotting in a 20th century person into a 24th century show, if you catch my meaning. Like,
yeah,
I don't know that people would struggle with their sexuality in the Federation the same way that they did in 20th century America and 21st century America, frankly. So it would have maybe seemed a little odd.
So, like, recently, and if you subscribe to our newsletter in December, you would have read this, I watched the show Ellen, which is around the same time, right? Like, Ellen's character came out in 1997.
Yeah.
And that's around when this is pretty contemporary to this season of Voyager. And one of the things I thought was very, I mean, and in the seasons prior to that, yes, she dates a couple of guys, but it always feels very weird. She never has any particular chemistry with them as an actress or as a character. And, you know, the whole struggling of her, you know, eventually realizing who she is and coming out, and the announcing to her friends and all of that, that in 2017 feels very quaint and old-fashioned in that way. Like, who decides to come out by gathering all their friends and family together and making an announcement? I mean, does that happen anymore? You know, it seems like kids come out of the, you know, out of pre-K and realize that, you know, they're queer these days. I read a statistic to this today that 27% of teenagers in California decide, you know, to identify as trans or non-binary or, you know, something along the gender spectrum. And it's like, this is very foreign to us, and
yeah,
you know, we're not that much, you know, I mean, I'm 35, we're not like a ton older than that, so, you know, in, you know, a few hundred years in the future, in the Federation, which likes everybody, like, Harry, you know, for Harry Kim to have that struggle is weird.
Yeah, I think that's what I would come down to, is that, yes, I think if Harry Kim was gay, that would have been fine, but I think it would have been a little odd. And I guess I'll just leave it there. And I
mean, the way that Discovery handles Stamets is makes a lot of sense, works with it. It's a, you know, non-issue. He's in a relationship with another guy, and, you know, everyone's just like, oh, that's cool. You know, let me get some romantical advice from you, because you're the only buddy person who
has a successful relationship. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. And I mean, I was about to say too, I was about to bring up Discovery as well, which is funny that, you know, and I think we've mentioned this before, but you know, Discovery has gone, you know, about as far as Star Trek should have gone in the 90s with a gay character. And, you know, it's time for an asexual character, non-binary, trans characters on Star Trek. I mean, I think that, you know, Discovery has sort of broken that barrier a little bit. And I think it's time to move forward even more with that. So, you know, but I would not want it to be a big thing. I would not want it to be an Ellen-leveled style coming out thing. That would make no sense for Star Trek. So,
yeah,
we will
see. Again, even for a show set in today, now, it would make no sense for that.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you for that comment. We got some interesting discussion out of it. So if you would like to leave a comment, again, the place to do so is trekaboutshow.com. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, we are there. Trekaboutshow is our username in all those places. Like I said earlier, you can check out our Patreon, patreon.com/truckaboutshow. It also supports our other podcast, Tuning In. We are talking about the X-Files episodes Terma and Paper Hearts this week. And finally, please leave us an Apple Podcast iTunes review for Truck About. It is the best way for new fans to find the show. We do have a new review this week.
What? This is like the biggest fan interaction week now.
Just wait until I tell you the next thing. Now, this is from Dr. Super, who says, love what you guys are doing. Short, simple, and to the point, Dr. Super. We like what you're doing. Thank you for that review. All right, next week we're going to be talking about the Star Trek Voyager episodes Revulsion and The Raven. Yes, Star Trek Voyager does a tribute to Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven.
Oh, boy.